The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Stelios.
Hello.
And I'm Josh. And today we are going to be talking about the Tao Te Ching, which is an ancient Chinese book on philosophy. This is my own personal copy and I'm going to be reading from this. So you don't have to necessarily read it, although I do suggest you read it because it's not very long and quite easy. And I think it's more a book, not necessarily just to read, understand and replicate, but something to read and reflect on. It's a bit of a different approach to philosophy than you might be used to, because sort of contemporaries of the ancient world, people like Aristotle and Plato, they wrote down exactly what they meant in excruciating detail in many cases. However, in this book, it's more in verse form and it's more of an interpretation. And I actually prefer that way of presenting things, because I find a lot of philosophy quite laborious to read and a bit of a chore. And it's like, why don't you just get to the idea and disseminate it down into a couple of sentences? Well, that's what this is, which I very much appreciate. And I did cover this book briefly in an early 2021 Contemplations about Taoism, but I didn't talk about the book exclusively and nearly as much detail as I would have liked. And this is my opportunity to rectify the situation, and I feel like I've done a much better job in teasing out the philosophies within. And also, I feel like this book is quite a good antidote to a lot of the shortfalls of Western philosophy. I don't know whether you feel the same, Stelios, as someone who's a bit more well-versed in philosophy than, well, a lot more well-versed.
Haven't made up my mind yet.
Mm-hmm.
I must say that I found it very metaphorical.
Mm-hmm.
It's really rich in metaphor. But I think also that being literal is a virtue. And I haven't made up my mind. I think it's really a really rich text and it generates meanings. And it has lots of commonalities with ancient Western philosophy. But there are also some differences. And I think that it would be really premature for me to say right now whether I prefer one or the other tradition, because mm-hmm. it seems that are texts that we constantly revisit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just
a matter of either or, is it? You can kind of have a combination of both. You don't have to pick, okay, well, I'm either going with the Western or Eastern. I think that reviewing the wisdom and the commonalities between all of them is the best way, and I'm sure you feel the same, right?
No, I do.
So, first of all, it's probably worth asking the question, what does Tao or Tao, they can both be spelt the same way, so I think D-A-O is the closer to the way in which it's said in Chinese, but it's quite often spelt Tao or T-A-O, and I think that's normally because the first letter in the word is a combination between T and D, so you've kind of got to find a balance between the two, which, funnily enough, is a recurring theme throughout the book, looking for balance between two extremes. But this term roughly translates as the way or the path. And allow me to read one of the verses. I'm just going to refer to them as chapters in this book because that's what it calls them, but they are pretty much verses. So it says, to look but not to see is called ye. To listen but not to hear is called she. To strive for but not to attain is called way. These three things are beyond our comprehension, and together they form the Tao. It is neither bright above nor dark below. Endlessly linked, it cannot be defined as it returns to nothingness. The formless form, shape without substance, it is called the abstract. From in front you cannot see its beginning, from behind you cannot see its end. Understand the ancient Tao to order the affairs of today. This is the essence of the Tao. So that's quite esoteric, isn't it? It's not exactly very clear what it is, but it's trying to say that it is the middle way between two extremes, at the very least.
You know,
that much is clear.
This is interesting because I think, from my notes, in the first chapter, called mm-hmm. The Mystery of the Tao, it starts by saying the Tao that we can comprehend is not the eternal and infinite Tao. And the names that we give are not eternal and infinite names. So to my mind, it does seem to me, at least on first notice, to be a bit contradictory. Because the whole book seems to be a bit paradoxical in that we start with saying that the Tao cannot be comprehended and cannot be spoken of. And the whole book speaks of it.
But is this not the dichotomy between subjective and objective understandings of reality, in that there's an objective way of being or a Tao, but you only have your subjective interpretation of that way? You can try and gain an understanding of it, but you'll never actually achieve the understanding, a perfect understanding, say, of the Tao objectively how it is, or the way of the path, which I think is a reasonable thing to say. It's basically saying there is an objectively right way to be, but you will never actually comprehend it because you come from a limited perspective. That would be a more modern way of saying it.
Could there be another way of viewing it that would imply that the Tao is ineffable?
Mm-hmm.
And that instead of saying that on the one hand we approach it through the prism of a distinction between objective and subjective, we approach it through a distinction of what we can speak about and what we cannot. And whether there is this idea of there being an eternal order in life that we cannot approach with language, but we can somehow grasp in some other way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is worth mentioning at this point that The text is deliberately written in ways in which it evokes multiple different understandings of the same thing. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, this is a tool to be reflected on. It's not necessarily telling you exactly what you should do, because one part of the understanding of the Taoist is that people need to get to a point of balance in their lives, and different people have different deficits, and that they need to balance out. And therefore, to give a clear instruction manual would mislead people, because everyone's needs are different depending on the individual. And therefore, it's better to set someone on the correct path, or which is where the term Tao seems to be most associated with, than it is to tell them the correct conclusion, because everyone's conclusions will be slightly different for how they get to the same end point. I think that's a fair thing to say. Do you agree?
Yeah, it does make sense.
Mm-hmm. So I think to understand the book, it's also worth mentioning that the author of it may or may not have existed. So the author is referred to as Lao Tzu or Lao Tzu, which directly translates to old philosopher or old master. So it's not actually a person's name, it's almost a pseudonym. So it could be multiple people. They could have never have existed, and this could have been a work of multiple people.
Yeah.
We just don't know. but it's traditionally credited to an individual. It might be a similar situation to Homer in the West, where it's such an old text that we don't really know whether they existed or not, whether it's a pseudonym. However, analysis of the linguistics and the rhyme structure seem to indicate that it was written around the 6th century BC, although there has been lots of debate about when this was actually originally written, and the estimates seem to range between the 3rd century BC and the 8th century BC, largely in the spring and autumn period of Chinese history. So it's worth mentioning what the actual purpose of the book was. Why did they bother writing it all the way back then? And I think that a historical perspective is the best one to lead with, because this period of Chinese history was a period of quite tumultuous warfare.
Okay.
There was lots of conflicts, and I think that there's lots of advice given to people like rulers in this book that makes you think that, well, this is intended as general advice to give people greater amounts of wisdom, but many of them are framed to give wisdom to rulers specifically. And I'm going to read a couple of the chapters. I'm going to go to chapter 66, which is perhaps one of the more explicit examples. So, the reason why the rivers and oceans are lords of the valleys and streams is because they occupy the lower position. This is why they can rule over them. For the same reason, an enlightened man who wishes to rule over people must, in his speech, take the humbler position if he wishes to lead them. He takes his place behind them. In this way, although he is above them, he does not oppress them, and although he leads them, he does not lead them into harm. Thus the world delights in his rule and does not tire of it, because he is in conflict with no one, and no one cares to be in conflict with him. And that's actually one of the rare examples whereby it's quite clear what they're trying to say here, isn't it?
I have two things to say here. So one thing is that it seems to me that there is a commonality between ancient Western ethics or virtue ethics in the ancient West, Western world, and the Tao Te Ching.
Yes.
Because there is this focus on the person of practical wisdom, and practical wisdom is the trait that a wise ruler must have, or that a ruler must have. Mm. And it's all about how to rule. And it's interesting because if we look at this, there is a distinction between ancient approaches to ethics and Enlightenment approaches to ethics, because the action guidance is focused on what kind of person one must be, as opposed to what to do in specific cases.
Yes.
And I think that's a common theme.
Certainly, yeah. And I think it's actually quite a good approach to it, because I think that with specific circumstances, it garners specific types of responses, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And when you talk about general instances, or this is the way you should live your life in the abstract,
yeah,
when it's not grounded in practical circumstances, well, it can allow one, without the proper grounding, to go off into the weeds, and you can get things like Rousseau, who's got some pretty insane ideas about humanity and human nature that I feel could only be come up with by someone who sat in a room full of books with no actual worldly experience.
And the second thing, which I think you will find very interesting, because it directly affects politics. The thing is, and I want to ask you about this, because it seems to me that it could be used as a tool for asserting authority without justifying it. Because if authority is to be justified in terms of in terms of a wisdom that is ineffable, and a wisdom that cannot be supported by reasons, that we cannot make a case for it, but you know, it's just we portray those who criticize us as unenlightened. Mm-hmm. Could it not be a dangerous tool in the hands of, let's say, politicians or those who have aspirations to rule? Because they could have a very metaphorical approach towards their thinking and speak in terms of metaphor. And every time someone tries to criticize them in terms of reasons, they would say, no, this is, you're unenlightened. The unenlightened person tries to speak about these things because the Tao is ineffable.
Mm-hmm.
Could that not be misused?
Well, I mean, any any form of transcendental belief system can be misused in that way. I mean, you could use the example of the divine right of kings, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Whereby they could say, well, I'm the king. I am whatever my will is God's will because I am the king.
Yes.
And so you could get a similar situation. But I feel like built into Taoism is the notion that your station doesn't necessarily dictate how enlightened you are or how far along the path you are, in that in many ways a man who has nothing has is more of a Taoist than someone who is a ruler because they are not burdened by worldly considerations necessarily. And we'll see those themes play out. But I think that what you raise there is still a valid concern, but I think that it's true of a lot of other things as well.
Yes,
it's not necessarily specific to this.
That's beyond doubt.
So it's also worth talking about some of the themes that are actually discussed here. So following the way of the Tao seems to be things like practicing humility, being non-violent where possible, valuing things that are simple, controlling and eliminating desires that seem superfluous, that are unnecessary. You should still have things like desires to have a family, to eat food, these sorts of desires, but desires for things like wealth and status, as it instructs, they come with their own problems and you will still find yourself unfulfilled, which in a time of probably scarcity, that is quite a wise thing because, of course, 6th century China doesn't have the plenty that we have today, and people are still falling afoul of that lesson. It's also, it places a large significance on cultivating inner peace, and it's about tranquility, and we'll see that being perfectly level and balanced is certainly a theme, and it relates it to water in particular, which will be one of the things we'll talk about. And things like non-action, which it uses this term a lot, non-action being the path to the Tao, but non-action doesn't actually mean doing nothing necessarily. And what it's trying to do, I think, in talking about non-action is that it's cautioning that sometimes the best solution is letting things play out as they will. And I think it's trying to mitigate the human tendency of whenever something goes wrong, for example, we always want to come up with a solution. Sometimes just leaving it and saying, okay, well, anything I do could potentially make this situation worse. There's a lot of wisdom there, particularly because it complements my political views in that whenever the government interferes, it makes something worse.
I think you raise many points here, and I have to separate the non-action part, which I'm not rejecting, but I haven't properly understood. Let's leave that aside for a moment. I think everything else you said shows a really healthy approach, I would say, to cultivating inner peace, because it says that focus first on your own affairs.
Mm-hmm.
Try to...
It's like Jordan Peterson, isn't it? Clean your room.
Yeah.
That's the whole point of that, is clean your room before you face the world.
But tend to your soul as well. And try to fix your soul before you try to attempt to fix the whole of the world, the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And I think that there are some passages in the book that says that the formulation was the greatest general is the one who won himself. And I find that this is a really important focus on self-mastery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really important thing. I really like the theme of self-mastery throughout the book, which gets me to the question of how does non-action relate to mastery? Because, I mean, if I approach it literally, non-action seems to me to be leading towards a kind of resignation.
I think,
but it doesn't seem to be that this is the message of the book. So how does this relate to self-mastery?
Mm-hmm. And I think that part of it might be a translation problem because, of course, this is a very old Chinese book and it's translated into modern English. And I think that the large variance of translations, because I've read multiple different translations, and some reorder the verses, some translate things to mean entirely different things, and it's not perfect. I'm going with the translation in this book, not necessarily because I feel like it's the best one, although I find it quite compelling. It's more so that the point of the book isn't necessarily to be understood literally. It's meant to be something that's thought-provoking. And even if the translation's a bit off here and there, you can figure out through the general themes of the book what the actual the literal translation was meant to be. But not only that, it's not the purpose for you to read it and just regurgitate or just embody it. You're meant to actually think about it and come to conclusions on your own. And I don't think that this main role of the book has been impeded by the fact that it's not necessarily been translated in a way that we would prefer.
Okay, so I think that's interesting because I had an idea right now. Would you say that we could approach the text as being somehow art? Each chapter is like a painting, and by the author or the tradition of, you know, whoever was involved in sustaining the tradition of this book, sort of try to engage in a kind of moral or artful education of the readers. Like in the same way that we could say that there are some kinds of music that we feel that they are purifying our soul. Mm-hmm. So would you say that this could make sense?
Well, I think they're trying to, with each verse, it's trying to take a snapshot of either a sort of intellectual disposition or an emotional one about how you should either order your thinking or order your emotions. And it's not necessarily saying it in quite those terms, but it's alluding to certain dispositions that aren't necessarily as conscious as lots of the other topics that lots of other philosophers of the time would discuss. Like lots of philosophers would talk about the nature of thoughts or of perception or things like that, whereas this is more focusing on things that might be a bit more instinctual, I suppose. Okay. And I think that the medium suits the thing that it's trying to target.
Okay, yeah.
So throughout the book, there are two sort of meta themes that run through everything, and that is its emphasis on the virtues of naturalness, known as ziran, or non-action, which is wu wei. And we're going to talk about these themes before we talk about some of the more, I suppose you could call them sub-themes, or some of the more grounded themes that give you more direct guidance rather than giving you sort of a vibe.
Okay.
So first of all is ziran, which is a term that refers to the natural state or flow of things and is characterized by spontaneity and effortless functioning. It is often translated as naturalness or unforced, obviously, because it's a Chinese character. It's more of a symbol that represents lots of meanings. You get this with Japanese lettering, where one letter could mean many seemingly completely disparate things. And you, by directly translating it, you lose a lot of the associations that someone from that specific culture would understand.
Okay.
So there is that element to it. But the significance of this in Taoism is that being natural is seen as being in harmony with the way of living that best suits the world around you.
Okay.
Generally speaking, this is phrased as being natural and natural being good. But of course, we know of lots of things that are natural but not good. And it doesn't necessarily talk about those. It doesn't say, yes, getting ill from a mosquito is good because it's natural.
Okay.
It's more focusing on, I would pose this is my own interpretation, as acting more on your unconscious mind than your conscious mind, because it's more in tune with being natural.
Okay, I think we could introduce a distinction here between two notions of the natural.
Mm-hmm.
Approached through one sense, the natural is that which happens. Everything that happens is natural.
Well, I mean, a computer is natural.
Yes.
Because it's produced by an animal, which is us.
But you could say that, you know, crime is also natural in that sense. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there is another notion of natural that is also used in the natural law tradition, where the natural is a normative sense, in the sense that something can fail to be natural.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that it cannot fail to be natural if it is part of nature in the descriptive sense. So it seems to me that the notion of the natural that is used here is a normative one, because there is a clear sense throughout the whole book, despite its metaphorical nature, that most people do not follow the way.
Yes.
And that most people do not follow the natural, you know, path in that normative sense. And on the other hand, there is the Tao is supposed to be a path to enlightenment, which is a more normative state than just being.
No, that makes perfect sense by my mind.
Okay.
So carrying on with Ziran, it's often contrasted with the notion of deliberate action and manipulation, which is seen as being in opposition to the natural flow of things, leading to conflict and disorder. So, for example, the act of building a dam would be seen as against the Tao, because you're trying to control the way of nature. You've set up a scheme which ultimately is going to fail. And if you're talking about the Three Gorges Dam in China, well, the build quality of that is basically guaranteed that it's going to burst its banks one day. But yes, it's about having these deliberate actions that are seen as against nature, as you were saying, but the normative nature. And this part, I feel, is a little bit difficult to understand without proper examples, because it can be misleading based on how you describe it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to read some chapters in a minute that are going to talk about this. So the idea of cultivating a principle of Ziran, you can cultivate a state of effortless action and non-interference, allowing things to unfold without trying to control or manipulate them, but yet you still are at peace or in some way benefiting from this. So things like simplicity, contentment, and peace are tied up in this sort of meta principle. But I think it's easier for me just to read what it has to say about it rather than describing it. So I'm going to read from chapters 21 and 25. This one's titled The Origin of All Things, and it says, "The great virtue takes its form from the Tao, and the Tao is vague and insubstantial, so vague, so insubstantial, and yet it has form, so vague, so insubstantial, and yet it has substance, so deep, so dark, and yet within its essence of life. The essence is real, and within it is truth. Throughout time, the name of the Tao is constant, and through it I can discern the origin of all things. How can I discern the origin of all things? From this, from the Tao." So it's a little bit confusing there, because it's, again, got its signature contradictions there. Is trying to suggest that the Tao is present in all things to a certain extent.
Yeah.
That's what it's trying to get at, and particularly natural things. I think that chapter 25 will probably help clear it up. So, "This is something born of chaos, created before heaven and earth, voiceless, formless. It stands alone, unchanging, ceaselessly circling, the mother of creation. I do not know its name, but conscious of temerity, I call it the Tao. Conscious of my temerity, I call it great. Calling it great is also to say it is in motion. Saying it is in motion is to say it travels far. And to say it travels far is to say it returns to itself. Thus the Tao is great. Heaven is great."
That's too much for something that is supposed to be ineffable. But okay, that may be a cheeky thing to say. What I really find interesting, and again, I think that this is a common theme throughout philosophy, is that there is this notion of two selves, or two aspects of the self, that many philosophies have. And I think that there is, on the one hand, the, as you would say, the lower self that is part of the world of daily affairs. And in another sense, there is a sort of higher self, as many would say, I don't necessarily buy into this way of phrasing it, but I'm just using it.
Yeah, and
it
do carry on.
No, it seems to me that there is a focus in many traditions on identifying with the higher self. And here it seems that the higher self is more in tune with the Tao, whereas the other part of the self that does all the things that this book counsels against, like, you know, having attachment to earthly things.
It doesn't necessarily, earthly things. I was going to say attachment in general, it says nothing about it.
So I have here, for instance, I think it's chapter 2 in Not Doing, where it says, the wise man acts through not doing, teaches without words, interacts with creation without initiating. He makes but does not own, acts but does not rely on the result, achieves but does not linger to be recognized. In not seeking recognition, his credit becomes enduring. So we could say that recognition or a sort of fame is an earthly thing. It's not as important as the inner peace of someone. Mm-hmm. So I would say that this is an interesting thing to detect in all sorts of philosophies, that they say that don't focus so much on what other people think about you. Focus so much on becoming good. Mm-hmm. And recognition may or may not come, but it's not the most important thing in life.
Yes. And I think that Taoism directly says that normally recognition for your feats seems to suggest some sort of pre-expectation. If you're a benevolent emperor who does everything right, well, it's not a notable thing that you make the right choices, because that is what you do. It's so synonymous with you that people don't even think it worthwhile to praise you, because they know that is in your nature. And that's the situation that the Tao holds up as ideal. It's not necessarily saying that you shouldn't get acknowledgement for being good. It's just that you need to get to the point of being so good that people almost feel like they're wasting their breath telling you that. So I think that it's not necessarily trying to invert anything, not that you were saying that either, but that's what it was trying to get at, in my opinion. So one of the other key themes throughout this is that of Wu Wei, which refers to the idea of effortless action. So it can be translated as doing nothing or going with the flow or letting nature take its course. But I think that that's making it sound like it's some sort of weird hippie nonsense, just like, hey, man, chill out, man, that sort of thing. But that's not what it's trying to say.
So you think it's an uncharitable interpretation?
Yes, I think that what it's trying to say is that there's lots of virtue in not interfering with things and allowing things to take their course, and that the predisposition that they're trying to mitigate here is doing stuff. And it doesn't necessarily argue against doing things. It just says, just be aware that what you do might have unintended consequences, and interfering too much tears things apart. There's actually a chapter where they talk about cooking a small fish, and too much attendance to it makes it disintegrate and fall apart.
Would you say that we could approach it in the following way? Anything that we are told not to do or to abstain from doing, or everything that is supposed to be a character of action that is not an enlightened action, belongs to the self that seeks recognition and has messed up value system. Mm-hmm. And that in that sense, when they talk about effortless doing or non-action, they mean non-action in that sense.
Yeah, and as in not deliberately going out of your way to get fame and recognition and being a tyrant.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.